Hiya.
Welcome to another episode of Zero Ambitions, a podcast about sustainability and the built environment. So this week's episode was inspired by Lloyd's trip to Paris. He was there for the Buildings and Climate Global Forum as part of a whistle-stop tour of Europe, where for the last few weeks he's been in London, hanging out with people, and he's on his way to the Passive House Institute's annual conference. Anyway, that doesn't really matter right now. The reason for this episode is he arrived in London from Paris massively enthused and excited by his experience there. And he wanted to communicate that with our listeners. So the outcome of the forum was this Declaration de Chaillot. I think that's it. I'm sure Kelly pronounces it with a much greater degree of confidence in the episode. That's Kelly Alvarez-Doran. Right. In response to it, like, the event was 1,400 people, 70 countries for this Buildings and Climate Global Forum. Lloyd, while he was there, hung out with Kelly Alvarez-Doran, previous guest, half climate design, formerly Hamas, blah, blah, blah. Check the episode earlier in the year. And he was also there with Will Arnold. And Will Arnold is head of climate action at the Institute of Structural Engineers. We get the impression they were similarly enthused. And Lloyd wanted to get the gang back together to talk about it. So, yeah, we did. We had a really good conversation. To be honest, I didn't really know anything about it other than Lloyd was excited about it and he wanted to talk about it. So I said, yeah. Anyway, I'm glad we did, because this declaration feels like quite a positive sign, at least potentially. It's pulling together a lot of the usually loose strands of how we appreciate and think about the built environment and focusing attention on what needs to be done in order to make it work better for everyone in it, as well as working better for the environment around us. So you can imagine we talk about a bunch of the usual things: embodied carbon, resource efficiency, use less stuff is a phrase that Will Arnold coined. Lloyd certainly credits him. But yeah, I'll let you listen to it. Three bits of housekeeping. There's a point in which Kelly refers to a slide that he's pulled up on screen. It doesn't really matter that you can't see it. It was instructive in the moment, but having listened back in the edit, I couldn't remember what it looked like, and I didn't feel like I was missing out. And I wanted to acknowledge that this is very much a manual, like, very narrow representation. The intention wasn't to be exclusionary, it's just happenstance. Lloyd invited the folk he was with to talk about where they were. I'm sure we'll try to do better in the future. And Jeff turns up late, gate crashing halfway through. That's about it, I think. All right, I won't keep you. Hope you enjoy it. Cheers. Thank you for joining us.
Dan, take it away. Start us up.
All right. Cheers, Lloyd. Because we are in the same time zone, we've been trying to find a way to meet up, and we sort of failed last week through a mixture of illness, poor organisation and bad weather. But we took the opportunity to have a chat, and I wanted to find out what he'd been up to in Paris, because it sounded... But in fact, I got a very enthusiastically typed email from Lloyd about what had gone on and alluding to something he wanted to speak about with great urgency. Turns out it's this podcast. He came away from meeting you guys, Kelly, who we already know, and I think you met Will for the first time.
We've been speaking on and off for a couple of years.
Last year when I was here, the three of us had coffee in London and it was wonderful. And that was the first meeting I had in person with both of them.
So it was just ebullient with enthusiasm.
It was our second date, Dan.
Second date. And as with all good dates, it happened at a climate conference, which is when
in Paris.
Second date. Paris. Yeah. Paris, the city of climate.
So Lloyd comes back from this climate conference, desperate to talk about it. So he said, can we gather these heads together and talk about why he's so enthusiastic? Because I think you mentioned that it's the first one of those events you've been to of that ilk, Lloyd?
Well, yes, I was absolutely over the moon and enthusiastic. When I got there, I thought this is going to be a big bureaucratic nothing. And I came out of it, particularly after reading the declaration that came out of it, really excited that it was not mumbo jumbo. It was concrete recommendations for all of the stuff that I've been talking about for years. And there was, it was broken into sections, like we acknowledge that building and construction is responsible for a huge amount of a demand. And it came up with objectives. And the objectives were really interesting and comprehensive, and I think radical in some ways. So I've asked these two gentlemen and we've to be on here, and I guess we should introduce again who everyone is. So Kelly, why don't you describe again who you are? You've been on this show before.
Yeah, I've been your longtime listener, second time caller. Yeah, I'm Kelly. I'm an architect living here in London. And I guess I was invited to Paris through my affiliation with Architecture 2030, basically as a follow-up on, you know, attending COP in Dubai in December, which Dan and I spoke to a little bit on the episode I was on. But yeah, this one, you know, like yourself, spoke on a couple panels. Well, anyways, we'll get into it. That's who I am. Good to be back.
And Will?
Yeah, so I'm a structural engineer by background. I actually first met Kelly when I went to work with him in Rwanda back in 2018, a project we worked on together that kind of changed my outlook on structural engineering and what good design looks like in terms of the need to do better things for people and the rest of the planet. And I moved into sort of working in sustainability since then. So I attended the forum purely as a participant, which was very nice because usually these things I end up having to talk and prepare. I got to just turn up and speak with everyone that I know from the industry and work out what we were going to do next. So, yeah, I mean, for me, the conference was amazing because I don't think anything like that's been run before, specifically looking at buildings with respect to the climate with such a sort of multinational perspective. And so to see all these people in a room together all sort of tackling this problem was really quite something, I felt.
And I should mention that I was asked to be there by people from Architecture 2030, primarily because I've written often about sufficiency, questioning how much do we really need. And there was a whole section on sufficiency operated, set up by the French bureaucrat Marine Gérard, responsible for sufficiency, which is a big deal in France. They call it sobriété. So I was coming to Europe anyway for the Passive House conference and just thought, well, I'll just stretch out this trip so that I can bookend it with Innsbruck at one end and Paris at the other end and camping out at my sister's in London in between. So that's why I'm here.
So, I mean, I don't really know an awful lot about this, Lloyd. Like, I've been quite busy in the last week. So I'm trusting in you. So what I want to know is, what is particularly significant about this? Because we've seen an awful lot of these sorts of declarations. We've probably all signed plenty of things, not just internet petitions, but like we've all been involved in signaling a way forward, like in all sorts of capacities. So why are you so optimistic about this one in particular? Like what's going on here?
Well, I'm taking it at its word. The key point of it is to create momentum for building decarbonization and climate resilience by reinforcing international collaboration and making calls for commitments, so that they didn't actually sign an agreement saying, we've made this commitment. They basically made this call for individual nations to make these commitments. So you could say, well, it's really not much of anything. On the other hand, it's put into words things that I have not seen before, like recognition of the impact of the building and construction sector, the recognition that material demand to make new buildings is going to nearly double by 2060, that construction materials dominate that. And then operational objective, section 5, which goes through and lists a pile of things that architects and planners and engineers talk about, but never actually get into building codes and into laws and into zoning bylaws. And I'll just list a few that I highlighted for further discussion. You know, build only in appropriate areas, minimize urban sprawl and loss of natural land. This is a huge issue, I know, in the UK with the Green Belt under pressure around London. It's a huge issue where I live in Ontario, Canada, where the government basically wants to pave the province. And suddenly, you know, United Nations Environmental Program and governments are saying, no, we shouldn't do this. It's promoting dense, socially, functionally mixed-use spaces when we're used to sprawl. It's prioritizing reuse, repurposing, and renovation when everybody loves new buildings. And in one paragraph, I loved it. It just covered everything from you know, eco-design, biosourcing, energy-efficient materials, circular economy, sufficiency, my thing, waste prevention, storage of carbon in building materials. These are all things that to architects, they may be common knowledge. We're talking about those. But to governments, it's out there at the cutting edge. And so that's what I was so impressed with. And then in the end, they commit to consider these things and to get every nation to consider them. So I was just excited to see all these things put on paper and signed by all these governments because I've never seen this kind of thing before. That's my quick summary.
I think, to add to this, I was listening to a podcast recently with Cristiana Figueres on who led the work that led up to the Paris Accord. And she was talking in this podcast about how the COP process is not powerful because it gets world leaders to agree on what they're going to do and what they're going to sign as policy and so on. But her argument is that it's powerful because it sends signals to the markets as to what the world has agreed is important. And I think to Lloyd's point about this declaration and the power of it, I mean, effectively what it's saying the following 70 countries have agreed that within buildings, within the built environment, we need to act in the following ways. And we need to do so at a sort of systemic level because all of these things are interrelated and it makes reference to that. And that sends another stronger steel signal to the markets in all of these countries that this is the direction of travel that we're going in. And that gives confidence to investors and insurers and developers that building in sufficient ways, building with natural materials, building to avoid basements, building to avoid silly geometric stuff is the only route forward, really, in the built environment. Right. And it puts it all into one document and it's been signed by, you know, representatives of national governments. So it's pretty powerful. I think it's pretty powerful stuff, even if it doesn't say, you know, this is a law now in each of these countries as of tomorrow. It gives that signal that this is the direction of travel. And that's pretty important, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess just to add to it, you know, I'd say there's a few things to note on the declaration. It came out of COP. It came out of the Buildings Breakthrough, of which 27 countries signed the Buildings Breakthrough. And you'll notice that there's 70 countries signed on this Declaration de Chaillot. So that's momentum. That's a significant increase. I think that the key thing for me is it's a recognition internationally of the role of the built environment in the climate crisis. And until very recently, I think that, you know, as you can see, that I think it's 37%, 40%, it's hovering around 40%, right? Of the role of the built environment, you know, up until really recently, that wasn't really probably part of the public understanding of what it was going to take to reduce emissions. So I think so much is focused on transportation, food, and energy. And the reality is the built environment is, you know, at the nexus of all these things and conditions these things that we need to create a broad human behavior change. And so much of our behaviors are completely conditioned by the built environments that we live within. So it's really easy to think about how are you going to reduce transport emissions, but transportation is basically taking you from one part of a built environment to the other. You know, this, they're so interconnected. I mean, it's great to see momentum and it's great to see how the built environment really sits. It's the fabric of which all these other things sit upon, in the way that I think that land use and built environment, you know, that's what dictates everything in a way. Agriculture is a land use, you know, housing is a land use, and how these things have been planned and designed over time and how we're going to unplan them and redesign them, I think is the key question. For our last discussion, Dan, when we got into, you know, the real hard questions of the future of this country or many countries, I keep thinking that was one of the talking points on one of the sessions too, about this adaptation, not just efficiency, but adaptation. And, you know, I've been thinking more and more about that discussion and what the realities are. I mean, if you just looked at the tides in Bristol last week, and this one news, there's a news thing on CNN climate last week of this community in Massachusetts that spent like $500,000 importing sand, and it washed away in like 3 days.
3 days.
These are the canaries in the coal mine of the future of the questions that we need to ask, right? Like this recognition of a kind of the reality of the built environment and how we need to look at it in many different lenses is, you know, central to what this is.
you jumped on one of my favorite points that I make all the time, which is that I think it's always a mistake to say the building and construction sector are 34% of energy demand and 37% of emissions, because as Jarrett Walker has said, you know, land use and transportation are the same thing and spoken in different languages. That basically transportation is, as you said, driving between buildings. So you can't look at them separately. And I always say, you know, land use and transportation together is like 80%, and the 20% of industrial emissions are basically making the buildings and making the cars. And so that, you know, if you take away agriculture, which is roughly 15%, everything is one picture of land use and transportation and making stuff to make land use and transportation possible. And they get that in that one line, inclusive and qualitative, well-integrated neighborhoods, notably to improve sustainable mobility. So they're recognizing that it's all the same story here, which I think is really important.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and going forward on it, I spoke on a panel focused on urban planning. And, you know, as I like to start off this, like, hi, I'm, you know, Kelly, I'm Canadian. I've got the highest emissions per capita in G20 nation. You know, it's the kind of like the first admission of the AA meeting of this.
Right.
And the reality is, like, why do Canadians have the highest emissions? Well, we're slightly higher than the United States because we're slightly colder, but our houses are too big and too far apart. Simple.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So last week we recorded our first episode about what to do with office space. So like a sort of like a mass urban retrofit series, you know, because you can't just do it in an episode. We don't know enough about the subject. We got introduced to some architects at RKD in Dublin who, they're not sustainability professionals per se. They're focused on the commercial sector within the built environment. So retrofit is an essential part of what they do in terms of just the plain old retrofit before it became conflated with energy efficiency or sustainability or any of those issues. And one of the things we spoke about there was the urban planning aspect being really debilitating, because every facet of our built environment over the last, 30, 40 years has been built towards propagating urban sprawl.
70 years since the war.
All right, yeah, fair play, yeah. Now, that has changed somewhat in the last 20, 30 years, where high-density housing has become a bit more of a concern because you can make more money out of it. Expectations have been diminished in cities. But yeah, it's interesting to hear that this ties all of those things together and has a broader macro vision baked into it.
I think that the retrofit topics really sort of key. So there's a couple of 80% rules out there, right? So the first one is that 80% of the buildings that we'll need in 2050 around the world already exist, but most of those are in the global north. And the other 80% rule is that 80% of all construction that's going to happen between now and 2050 will be in the so-called global south. So in the rich, highly emissive countries of the world, such as the UK, such as Canada, such as our immediate neighbors, the challenge really is about how do we use what we already have. It's not so much about how do we build new buildings in a lower carbon, better way. Of course, that's still a problem and that still needs to be tackled. But the bigger issue is about how do we take that existing urban fabric and make it better. And what I thought was interesting in the declaration is that this comes up a number of times, and it comes up repeatedly because of the sort of multiple different challenges that the declaration is trying to tackle, right? So it's trying to tackle resilience. Increasing the resilience of our buildings and our cities to the changing climate, to natural hazards, to extreme weather events, and so on. It's trying to tackle the need to reduce the energy demand of our cities as they stand, particularly as our summers get warmer and we need more cooling in these parts of the cities that just become these urban heat islands. How do we also continue to modify and update our urban habitats in a way that's low carbon, that's low waste, that's low impact in terms of ecological damage and so on? And all of this gets neatly tied up in taking an existing building, making it more resilient, making it lower energy, and doing it all of this in a low carbon way. And so again, back to, you know, Lloyd's point about the declaration having these I see it as a sort of systemic approach, these linchpins within it that do multiple things at once. Retrofit comes up again and again because of that. And in the global north countries, it really is at the heart of what needs to happen in the built environment. We don't need to be having huge conversations about how do we make new stuff better. We need to have the big conversations need to be about how do we stop knocking stuff down, stop wasting buildings, stop having a single-use cup mentality to the biggest and heaviest things on the planet, and start using them better and upgrading them and upcycling them. So I thought it was really good to see that discussed again and again, both in the declaration and at the conference, actually, I should say.
No, that's a terrific point. Now, one thing I did want to get you to talk about, Will, is a year ago you wrote an article that I had to go back and revise my latest book a little bit to add when you wrote this article with this graph that ended up with the three words, use less stuff, which has almost become my three-word mantra after reading that article and put your diagram into my new book that's coming out all about it. And how do you feel in that whole pyramid that you showed? The first category was build nothing at all. The next was renovate what you have, then be very careful about materials, and in the end, use less stuff. And that's why I was so excited about this document, is it's the first time that sufficiency was ever in an official document. It did come up in the mitigation IPCC report, but just in the backup, not into the final substance of the report. And here, finally, people are talking about using less stuff. Did you get that? Did you see that throughout, or is that just the one-liner in here?
Yeah, I did and I didn't. I mean, some people get it. Some people get the fact that it's great to have a low carbon footprint per square meter, but to then apply that to a 2,000 square meter house for a couple is just madness, right? And, yeah. And you know, that's a lack of sufficiency, right? You know, we can make our next mansion out of the lowest carbon materials we can get our hands on. But if you don't need all that space, what a waste, right? Some people get it. I think I had a bit of a frustration, not even specifically at the conference itself. I guess it's an ongoing frustration in the industry that we don't talk about it enough, because those who don't get it often want to concentrate on the technologies, the lower carbon solutions, the lower carbon materials, and so on. And it's sort of to jump to that level of detail forgets that very first point of just, you know, what are we going to do with all this stuff when we put it together? What are we actually using it for? What's the value of creating all these materials and bringing them together? And that all comes back to sufficiency. The other thing on sufficiency that interests me is that when we reuse our existing buildings, I think we have to be really careful with how we go about doing that and not just assume that just because a building has been reused, it is necessarily the best thing we could have done with it for the planet. You could take an old warehouse and turn it into, one giant shop, for example. I'm not picking retail as a specific sector, but you could turn it into one big thing that's maybe completely not needed in the area where this building exists at all. And people have to drive from all over to go there, and so on and so forth. Another option could be that you turn it into housing, or you turn it into office space, or you turn it into whatever's needed in that place, and you do so in the most efficient manner. You get as much use out of that existing warehouse as you can, because you ask what's needed and then you sort of juice it for everything it's worth. And clearly those two different design solutions have a very different sort of value added to the community, to the planet, and so on. But they're both reuse projects. And so at the face of it, they could both be viewed as the same. Oh, we're reusing existing buildings to make something new. Great. But they're clearly not. And this comes down to how we use our spaces and what we get out of them. And that comes back to this sufficiency piece. I use the phrase use less stuff as a almost mantra as well, Lloyd. I think some people might be sick of me saying it. I say it so often. We sell on almost a daily basis. Right. And it's not, and I guess it's not quite the only mantra that we should have, right? Because what you use less stuff to do also matters. You need the both as a pair, I suppose.
Now, Kelly, I want to ask you, and this goes back to something Will said, the good point about the sort of 80% rule, I guess, as used to be called Pareto principle, that 80% of the construction that's going to be done is going to be done in the developing world and not in our world that we keep talking about, our Northern European, Canadian, and American world. What did you get out of this in terms of there was a huge presence at the conference from the developing world and from Africa and from Asia. Do you think that this document and these concepts discussed here are going to have any impact there, or are they just going to keep pouring more concrete?
Can of worms there, Lloyd.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that, frankly, there was not that much representation from the Global South, I would say, proportionately. It was a fairly European conference, but, you know, it's partially because there's a few reasons for that. That was in Paris. If you look at the signatory nations, there's a kind of distribution of them. But yeah, there was representation from, you know, upwards of 70 countries. I think I can only speak from my experience in that part of the world. You know, as Will mentioned, you know, we both worked in Rwanda, and I've been working across sub-Saharan Africa now for a while. It's just actually just in Cape Town the few days leading up to Paris. And I think that, you know, that assumption that 80% of the future buildings are going to be built in sub-Saharan Africa and other global South countries makes sense. It's in accordance with demography. I think that the reality that there's so much about living in Rwanda and practicing across East Africa mostly is that there are certain, there's certain kind of architectural tendencies that are replications of models we've seen elsewhere, right? Like buildings that look like buildings that are heavily reliant on air conditioning, buildings that are built out of materials imported exclusively from, you know, Southeast Asia, China, buildings that are built exclusively and funded with money from either China or from European sources. But there's also the majority of buildings are built with materials that are readily at hand. And I think that the work that I spoke to at the panel and previously work that Will and I had again engaged in with Mass Design Group was focusing on earth construction and recognizing that the vast majority of buildings, certainly where we lived and worked, were built by people, were self-built and built out of earth. And that, initially the paper that came out ahead of this, that United Nations Environment Program and NEO put together, it originally didn't even have earth as a family of materials in it. And I was one of the reviewers to help get that into the discussion. I think like recognizing what most of the world builds out of and understanding that what that is much lower carbon than what we've been building out of for the last century. And I think there's a kind of whole set of assumptions about what that 80% is going to look like. And I'm very optimistic it's not going to look like what we've been building for the last 100 years. And I think there's a lot more, you know, there's a lot more innovation and invention and creativity possible, certainly, you know, where we were practicing, because it's not preconditioned with the assumptions that I think we practice under. It's not preconditioned by the regulations and building codes that we practice under here, for better, I would say, in many cases. And also, I think that there's a desire to kind of find local solutions. I always explain, you know, the biggest driver of innovation in the work that we were doing in Rwanda is the fact that it's a landlocked country with an 18% import tax. And so you have to figure out how to make solutions local. And it's not going to be completely reliant on the global supply chains that we've been conditioned to assume as normative. Anyway, I'm kind of rambling, Dan, so cut me off.
Jeff, we've got a gate crusher.
Hi, sorry I'm late. Can you hear me okay, Dan? I'm on my phone.
But yeah, it's the morning after St. Patrick's Day, just to clarify that, Dan, actually.
Oh, yes, that's sorry, important. He's doing very well. Yeah, good boy.
Detail's important. I'm walking the dog. There's no euphemisms in that either. I'm walking Pooch around. I wanted to come in and gate crash this because, you know, the whole embodied carbon and building structures is very close to my heart. And Will is someone who I really wanted to speak to as well. Is Will here as well?
I am. Yeah. Hi, Jess.
Oh, there you are. Hi. Yeah, I've seen some stuff, Will, that you've published on embodied carbon with building structures in the past. Been very impressed. You know, you seem to be a strangely for an engineer, a good communicator too.
I'm not going to comment on the communication abilities of other engineers. There are many many engineers who are very, very good communicators, Jeff. I should introduce you to some of them at some point.
I know it's. I shouldn't be too pejorative. It's not a good foot to start out on. But yeah, you had a piece on embodied carbon with concrete, and I just remember there was an illustration with it which really stuck with me some time ago, and just the simplicity of the language was great. You strike me as somebody who actually wants to be understood, which is not as common a characteristic as it should be.
Well, you can say that very same thing about most architects too, that they do not speak in any way that is understood by the general public. And so that's why I'm so happy to have people like both Will and Kelly here, because they do communicate so well.
For sure. Sorry, I was just dealing with some dog business there.
Is that a euphemism?
No. Well, I don't know. It's not. It's a very thinly veiled one. If it was, no, you're dead right, Lloyd. And great to see you again as well. And Kelly, I mean Kelly, the episode we did with you before was very insightful and eye opening for me. And I'm really looking forward to working with you on that magazine article as well. You know,
one of the things that stood out to me again, because I'm self absorbed, is something I've been thinking about in terms of the... I presented some research we've been doing around deep retrofit in social housing when we were at Future Build the other week. And one of the key takeaways that came out of it was a need to foster a better sense of collaboration throughout the value chain in delivering retrofit in order to make it a success. And in this instance, we were looking at it from quite an emotional perspective, because it was the emotional part which determined whether it was a success or not. And in this instance, so in the declaration, one of the key pullouts was, one of the key aims was promoting collaborative value chains, as well as research and development of innovative solutions. And that ties to that insight from that particular project, this transformer project that we're working with, which is being led by Energiesprong, one of the Innovate UK, one of the things that is coming out of this Innovate UK net zero heat competition that was run last year. Now, promoting collaborative value chains on international lines, that sounds like a fierce challenge. I was interested that what you were describing there specifically with regard to Rwanda is collaborative value chains are the only way you get anything done in a situation like that. In the UK or North America, adversarial value chains, that's where it's all at by and large. So was much discussed about this particular subject, how to promote it or addressing the existing or inherent challenges that lie within what the value chains that we're already dealing with?
Well, I think that actually Will pulled out in his summary of the event a line that directly addresses that, which is governments commit to promoting collaborative value chains as well as research and development for innovative, sustainable, affordable, cost-effective, and healthy solutions. So, that phrase, collaborative value chain, is right in the document and is clearly a huge issue. Just yesterday I met for coffee in St. Pancras Station an engineer from Fort William, S. Tresider, who was describing working with some engineers who, mechanical engineers, who they're doing a passive house building, and they came in with water temperature over twice what was needed to deal with the passive house situation, that everybody's talking different languages, and his job now is being a translator. So I don't know about how much collaboration is actually happening. Kelly, you put up a slide. Let's talk about that.
This one was about the challenges and solutions around digital tools in lifecycle assessment. So I kind of presented the work that we'd been doing, in Rwanda, and the value chain. The problem, generally speaking, with construction value chains is there's not a lot of transparency along the entire thing, right? To really think, I'm specifying, from this supplier, and where did they get the materials and so on and so forth, right? The nutrition fact label for products and for buildings, it's a lot more complicated than food, right? Because there's more processes along the way, typically with construction materials, typically, unfortunately, but some know.
So, you know, this was kind of talking about in the context of Africa. When we started doing this accounting, this kind of embodied carbon or whole life carbon assessment, you could see there's basically, like this is about 4 years ago, there's zero data for this, the EPD systems, the environmental product declaration systems. And so we put together the first EPD working with a supplier, working with that value chain to understand it, right? And so really understanding the value chain from, you know, this person working here at the quarry to all the people working in that factory. And so that's start to finish from that kind of cradle to gate perspective, right? And that was critical for, again, this is the work that Will and I and others at Mass were doing. That was critical for us to make decisions we could stand behind and quantify. But I also then showed some of the work that we're doing in Toronto and how it really relies on, you know, to make better decisions as a designer, you rely on data from your supply chain, right? You rely on these EPDs. And we recently did a full review of a firm in Toronto's master specifications, CureCore Architects, with Brian Ballantyne Specifications, they write the specs for about half the offices in the city. And you can see like of the kind of fidelity of information in Africa is no different than it is in North America right now, that 72% of the things in a North American spec don't have data. So it's really hard to start to have nuanced discussions about value chain when you're starting with no information, right? This reality would be quite different right now in parts of Europe where it's been required. But we're, as an industry, because it hasn't been required, it's really hard to engage your value chain because it's fragmented. It's opaque and it's complex. There's more ingredients in a building than there is in your menu, which adds to the complication. But at the same time, I think like, you know, this is the role of architects and engineers and other people in the industry is to start asking these basic questions, where it come from. The nutrition fact label, like that was only created in the early 80s. I actually remember as a kid when it showed up on my cereal box. Like it's a recent creation, right? And until then, it did not exist. You know, I think regulating the sin and then having us ask these basic questions are going to help us like understand our value chain before we need to understand it before we can begin to engage it, you know, fundamentally. And then I think moreover, you know, if you're practicing in the UK right now, you can start to source locally again. And I think this is the, you know, to tie it to some of the other panels that were going on, the one around bio-based materials. If you're sourcing bio-based materials, it's not a very complex supply chain. It's pretty short, right? It's much shorter than it is a system based on a plastic or a petroleum product or a system based on a metal. Bio-based products are much smaller in geographic and stages along the process. Same with earth-based materials, like stone and brick are really simple to figure out. Whereas anything made out of aluminum or foams are more complicated inherently.
It's interesting on this. Sorry, Will, if I'm jumping in ahead of you. About 10, 11 years ago, maybe longer, when the Greens were in government last time in Ireland, the Minister for Environment asked me, John Gormley at the time, asked me to assist with the Green Public Procurement Policy for Construction, kind of identify a Green Party position on this. And we were looking at a raft of different things, including bringing in an embodied carbon calculation requirement. And I knew very little about embodied carbon at the time. But I recall at the time, part of the discussion was we brought in the ICE database, you know, the Craig Jones' work at the University of Bath, with these sort of default values for different materials, default embodied carbon values. And one of the architects from the Office of Public Works, the state's architectural practice, who were kind of tasked with trying to implement this, nothing ever happened in the end of it, I should say, came up with this argument against it, that, and I think a credible one, that the data points for a given material that a default was based on were oscillating so wildly. There was such a, you know, the error bar was, or standard deviation or whatever, was so massive that you couldn't say that they were defensible kind of values, you know, that the averages. So in other words, the absence of data, I think there I can speak from personal experience, the absence of credible data was a really strong counterpoint to doing anything. But the hope I find now, and I think that the driver at a European level, and the UK will see this too, don't know how much further it will go, is that just this week, Kieran Cuff, the MEP for Dublin, managed to smuggle through pretty profound revisions to the Energy Performance of Buildings Directive, including a requirement to calculate embodied carbon of all new buildings in Europe by 2030 and all new buildings over 1,000 square meters by 2028. So that's going to cause a requirement to very rapidly, you know, develop methodologies and force the supply chains to engage. So I just hope that that spreads further globally. But it seems to me like we have the beginnings of something very significant happening now.
Well, I think it is certain to spread globally, given that if any business has any sort of a footprint in the EU, which all of the big players do, they're going to have to be thinking about this stuff for all their other bits of footprint. So, man, that is quite an achievement sneaking that in. Sorry, Will.
It's the benefits of globalization, Dan.
So I wanted to pick up on a couple of things. There's quite a lot there that's just been said to try and unpack. But I suppose I want to pick up on two things in general. The first is to make the point that continents like Africa do not have a carbon emissions problem in the way that we do. And so I get quite frustrated sometimes when I hear people, and this was said at the conference actually in Paris, you know, people were saying things like, you know, oh, that part of the world doesn't have building regulations to the level of, you know, greatness that we have in the global north. That part of the world doesn't have enough EPD data. That part of the world doesn't understand material supply chains. Frankly, that's a distraction. It's not tackling the root issue. And to me, it's a bit of sort of tribalism, isn't it? You know, well, we're doing what we can, they're not doing what they can, and so on. But the fact is, the carbon footprint per capita in Africa as a whole continent, and it is a very big place, is about 1 ton of carbon per person per year. That's way below the 2050 target for the world, which is about 2 tons, which is where all countries of the world need to get to by 2050. Meanwhile, we're sat here in the UK where the number's nearer to 10 tons or something, right? So even if we have better standards and regulations and data in a place like the UK than we do in a place like Malawi, clearly that isn't the problem. And so then my second point is, I don't think we have a data issue. We have an issue with what people then do with that data and the decisions that are made off the back of it. If we go back to the sort of 1970s, say, and you look at concrete construction in the UK, it was pretty efficient, right? If we built a new office building, we'd be building waffle slabs, we'd be building rib slabs, we'd be designing to minimize our use of concrete because concrete cost money and labor was relatively cheap. We are now, what, 60 years in the future from there, 50 years in the future from there, we have access to better data, better design techniques, computer modeling, everything exists in 3D in the back of your brain before it ever gets to site. And yet somehow now we use, I don't know, nearly twice as much concrete per square meter to build the same office building that we were doing back then. It's not to do with the lack of data or lack of tools. It's to do with something else. So it comes back to the fact that now in countries like the UK, labor's expensive and materials are cheap. So we flipped this thing. It used to be materials are expensive, labor's cheap. Now it's the other way around. So what's the cheapest way to build a slab? You use as much concrete as you have to, as long as you minimize the amount of labor on site. What's interesting, well, when you work in so-called developing countries in general, is that you're back to the position we were in the 70s in the UK, where materials are the expensive bit. So when Kelly and I were trying to build this university in Rwanda, it was cheaper to employ more people to use less stuff rather than in the UK, where it's the other way around. So I think that, you know, it's good that we're working on data, good that we're working on EPDs. You know, the work that's been done on the IS database and so on is fantastic. And until you have a sort of common set of numbers for people to use, it becomes harder to get them all to discuss carbon in the same way. That's all true. But what matters more is what you then do off the back of those conversations. And we need to, you know, if you're going to slash carbon somewhere, it's got to be in the countries with the 10 ton per capita footprint, not the 1 ton. So there's a footprint, right?
Before you start, I just wanted to point out that every March 25th on Swedish Waffle Day, I do a long post about the glories and wonders of waffle slabs and do a tour of every waffle slab I've seen because they do so much with so little concrete. But, you know, nobody does them anymore because, again, all of the, they're so labor intensive to do the formwork and that. But look forward to Swedish Waffle Day for my annual report on them.
I think like that labor and materials thing too, it's the relationship, the cost of, you know, has flipped in the UK and Canada
where the reality is it hasn't. There's no such thing as a cheap material. There's just exploited cheap labor somewhere else, some other part of the world. It's tied, I think, in my mind, is very much tied to a kind of globalization question too, where we've figured out ways to source our supply chains from other parts of the world. I've got a thesis student at the Bartlett right now looking at the history of the use of Carrara marble in London from, you know, Nash's marble, I think, no, Marble Arch, which is Carrara marble, and then the Alexander McQueen store on Bond Street, which no longer has a Carrara marble interior. It lasted 5 years and now it's somewhere in a landfill probably. So there's like where all of that work was happening, never mind like it was getting extracted in Italy, but then where the actual finished work was happening was somewhere in Southeast Asia, as opposed to somewhere in the docks of London. And then how long it lasts in a building, like all these things I think are tied up together. And I think like that value chain, durability, use, exploitation, like all of these things are kind of, I think, the reality of a globalized system that treats architecture and buildings and the built environment as a commodity. Like that's a reality. And how do you make it as fast and cheap as possible, as opposed to making it lean and sufficient and last a long time? Like that the waffle slabs, everything you just said. Well, I think like data for me, data is a good way to get the conversation back to being sufficient and like helping people back into habits from the 60s and 70s and even before that. And, just mentioning this, like looking at the volumes of concrete and buildings. I don't know if you guys have published anything on this lately through iStruct D, because we're doing this year's half studio. We're looking at the buildings at the university from 1856 to 2000. And there's a Moriyama Tashima project, Lloyd, from the 70s at the University of Mississauga campus. It's all precast. It's amazing. It is so efficient. And now you never see this stuff anymore. You just see like, you know, big chunky slabs. And like, I remember when you first came down to Rwanda, we're like, okay, we're doing stone foundations, and it was you or someone else said, well, we've never been trained how to do stone. I'm like, well, go back, go find the textbooks, you know? I kind of wonder about the same thing with like precast, precessed concrete technology and buildings, like what's being taught these days in schools.
On sort of, yeah, weight of material that's being put into buildings. So a number I carry around in my head is 1 ton per square meter. So that's the weight of the Burj Khalifa's concrete, right? So biggest, tallest building in the world, they needed 1 ton of concrete to create every square meter of that building. Now that's quite a lot, right? So a ton weighs the same as a sort of small family car. You know, 2 tons is more like an SUV. So 1 ton is like a Fiesta, maybe a Ford Focus or something. 1 ton per square meter sounds like quite a lot. My ex-brother-in-law built a house extension out the back of his flat in central London because they wanted to get a second bedroom in. And because there was a tree reasonably close, I'd guess about 15 meters away from the back of his house, the engineer, who obviously, you know, for very good reasons wants to be quite risk averse, said, look, you're going to need some quite deep foundations. And the cheapest way to make deep foundations in a way that they wouldn't move as the tree sort of breathed and swelled over the year and moved the ground around it was to make concrete trenches 2 meters deep and nearly 1 meter wide, so you could put a person in them to dig them to 2 meters of depth. That extension, despite being just a single story high, also used 1 ton of concrete per square meter. And you know, done for seemingly good intentions. The engineer didn't want their client's building to move in the future when the tree, you know, caused the ground to go up and down. The client themselves, they didn't want to spend more than they had to. They'd saved a lot of money up to try and, you know, build themselves an extension on this quite cheap flat they'd bought so that they'd have something that they could stay in for a few years, all done with good intentions. But they ended up using as much concrete as we use to build the world's tallest building. Something is clearly not quite right in amongst all of that, is it? And so, yeah, I mean, to Kelly's point, stone foundations, you could do that in a flat in the middle of London, definitely. I mean, the Victorian terrace that this was built off the back of probably has foundations that go down about half a meter and are made out of brick and then sits on some compacted clay, almost certainly. So you don't need this mass of concrete, but it's kind of become the norm. And I think that until you've got to change the norm, if you want to get out of this problem, right, you have to change people's understanding that this is a problem. you have to make it so that when somebody builds a house extension and gets told they're going to build this concrete, they go, oh God, that sounds really bad. We, you know, concrete's bad, right? Isn't, are we sure that we need to do this? Is there not a better way to do it? We, ideally, we change it to the point where it becomes cheaper to do something else. It becomes cheaper to do shallow stone foundations or a small micro pile made with a reused steel tube or something like that. It's those are the changes we need to see if we're going to actually sort of like really tackle the scale of emissions in this industry, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so excited about the possibilities of stone that I'm going to interview Steve Webb of Webb Yates this afternoon, the engineering firm that is doing such marvelous things with stone, because I really think that we've just missed such an opportunity over the years by, as Steve Webb says, grinding up stone, turning it into concrete, and then turning it back into stone. Why not just use the stone in the first place? And I'll report back on that.
Will, there's something really interesting for the future that I want to dig into about this stuff with regards to structural engineering, because structural engineering in particular is massively impactful. So you know, just referencing the pile, it's a bit that you don't see. So Kelly's anecdote about crafting his cabin and then looking beneath his feet and realizing what a grotesque carbon burp he'd created where it wasn't absolutely necessary. I think because structural engineering is so fundamentally boring and not communicated around.
No. But
in the broader discourse, like people, hear me out. It is the subject which, like, we recorded two really interesting episodes with structural engineers, like fascinating insights that we weren't expecting, really engaging conversations. Yet because of that framing, like, we experienced a big drop off in listens. Like, that is the truth of the matter.
I think it speaks more to your audience, Dan, than the reality.
And our company.
Yes, exactly. Fucking exactly. And it speaks to the fact people are turned off by just the idea, because they'll listen to all sorts of other shite that we bollock on about. But, like, those had a big drop off. And I think that speaks to a fundamental problem, which I would like to address with you in the future, Will. So we'll have
You should have an episode just with Will. Or maybe he should bring in some other engineers and just talk about engineering.
Maybe we'll pretend that I'm an actor or something.
Yeah. I'm an alias.
Listen to, you know, I'll come up with a new name for myself. I think, it's you know, you're right. People don't get excited enough by what the slab looks like. And in most projects, it's then covered up from above and below. And the only person who gets excited when it's left on show is the engineer themselves. That is true. Most people don't want to look at a waffle slab in the way that I do. And I'm particularly excited to have heard that next Monday is International Swedish Waffle Day, so I can waffle on about waffles too. But you're right. But like something like, you know, it's half to two thirds of the embodied carbon of a building is the structure. Between 50 to 60% is the structure. These are all emissions that go into the atmosphere before you've even handed over the keys to the client. It doesn't matter what you know, over the next 60 years, how you use the building will change the profile of the remaining emissions. But in those 2 years you spent building it, all that carbon's gone to the atmosphere. You can't get it back out very easily. And most of that was the structure. And the reason why I got interested in this topic was the realization that this should be the low-hanging fruit, because it's one discipline. It's typically two materials or three materials, whereas if you look at even just an individual piece of facade, you've got maybe 10 or something to work out to deal with. The supply chains are relatively simple. So, you know, people often say, oh, local materials are the way to solve this. Actually, concrete's a really local material. So we should be able to understand exactly what the impacts are when we use it. It should be low-hanging fruit. And, you know, it's just big volumes of stuff piled up on top of each other. So there's loads of potential around dealing with carbon just within the structure. You can, you know, you can spend all the time you want faffing about with what you clad the building in. But frankly, if you put a six-story basement underneath there, all of which is structural concrete, you're not off to a good start in the first place, are you?
Well, this is it. What I wanted to ask you, there are a couple of little things there. One was when Kelly was talking about precast and efficiency and stuff. Precast, from everything I've seen, of course, and I'm sure Kelly would agree too, tends to be quite a bit higher cement content and more reinforcement. So in embodied carbon terms, the systems I've seen with precast tend to be higher embodied carbon. than other uses. And then linked to that, we've seen some cases in Ireland. I don't know how much of this got international attention, but we've had this very high profile building failure issue with mica contamination in blockwork. And there's a number of suppliers who've been affected by it, but in particular, it's on the northwest coast. And it was sort of perfect storm conditions that created this. But you have buildings that are like, you know, cavity wall buildings that are crumbling like soggy Weetabix, you know. Part of the reason seems to have been going against the grain of materials being cheaper than labor, that the concrete block manufacturers seem to have been trying to reduce the cement content in the blocks to very low levels, you know, as I say, a bunch of other factors causing it. But in other words, we are going to face this issue when we get into life cycle assessment of buildings, of trying to find sweet spot ranges to minimize embodied carbon of buildings without compromising structural performance. And I wonder, given our, you know, the missteps that the industry has made over the years on a bunch of different issues, RAC in the UK being a very, you know, reinforced often a dairy to concrete in the UK recently, in the schools being a case in point. How much rigor we need to apply to this, how confident we can be that we can make these steps in a way that enhances the lifespan of buildings and the integrity of buildings and the adaptability and so on of buildings, rather than compromising them.
I think so. The key thing here, right, is that there's no one product is going to solve the climate crisis. There's no silver bullet, no matter what. An individual manufacturer will always tell you that their product is lower carbon and, by the way, lower cost and quicker and blah, 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 blah. But it's not as simple as that. And precast concrete, to the point, can be higher and can be lower than reinforced in-situ concrete. It depends on a myriad of things. And frankly, you're tinkering with small numbers. And the same with most sort of arguments you have around off-site construction versus traditional construction methods. It's tinkering. The quickest way to reduce the embodied carbon of your structure comes down to much bigger fundamental moves than that. Are you doing big gymnastic heroic things with this building? If you're trying to hang a building from the roof, or you're putting big overhangs out the side of a building, that's going to cost you a lot of material, regardless of what material you choose to build it in. So number one, no gymnastics. And that's true on a sort of mundane scale as well. The most common example being where you have retail or restaurants at ground floor and apartment buildings, apartments or office space above it, and your columns come all the way down through your apartments or your offices, and then just above ground floor they have to move because somebody at ground floor wants them to be in a different place, and we have to build a big thick concrete slab to deal with that transfer. That's more gymnastics. Get rid of gymnastics. That's a big way to save carbon, and on top of that, it makes it quicker to build. It's much easier to understand, and therefore it's safer to build, safer to look after, easier to get the detailing right, therefore it's more durable, more resilient, and so on. The same is true of your grid size, so your column spacing in general. That, you know, the further apart you put your columns, it's going to use more material regardless of what system you choose to do it in. So the quickest way to save carbon is to put those columns nice and close together. So your columns that are close together and they run from the roof down to the ground in one go. They don't do any jiggery-pokery. And then ideally at ground, they stop. So if gymnastics is number one rule and column grid is number two rule, the third of the three rules is that they stop at ground floor and you don't have a basement. Because frankly, it's just a big, fat concrete box surrounded by so much concrete you wouldn't believe. And if you do those things, you take those three rules, no gymnastics, columns close together, no basement, that's where your biggest carbon savings come from. And you haven't talked yet even about what system you're going to build this thing out of. And then you're getting into your nuances. And then it becomes easier to have those conversations. But it tackles these things around safety and resilience and so on. You don't have to try and do silly things with your material specifications tweak out a bit more carbon because you've made the big moves right in the first place. I know, Kelly, a lot of the research you've been doing with your students at Toronto has looked into this, right? Like, it's looked into basements, it's looked into scaling and so on. So you've seen what this does to the numbers, right?
Like, starting with that hierarchy of mitigation perspective, right? Build nothing, build less, build clever, build efficiently, and then specify it low carbon. It's the last lowest efficacy thing that you should be doing, like at the very end of like, okay, can we shave another 15% off the cement that we're using? But so if I thought about building less, like, so let's just talk about you've done everything you've done. You've basically rationalized your grid structure. It's highly efficient. You don't have a big basement. I like to talk about that too a little bit. But then it's like, okay, we've got we've got a column beam slab system, what's the right way to do it? I mean, what we've seen is like, it's kind of intuitive things. So there's the waffle, there's the hollow core, there's bubble deck. If we're just in the world of like concrete slab systems, what do all three of those things do? They reduce volume. And by reducing volume, you're inherently reducing emissions. You're inherently also reducing weight, which also has other impacts on the size of your foundation. So there's interrelationship there. Some of them are things you could do on site in situ. Some of them have to be done offsite, you know, either off on another part of the site and then site erected, or done in a factory elsewhere. And I think the history of successes and failures of all these things are, you know, construction's not monolithic, but I could say just pointed to my knowledge, which is in Canada, specifically in Toronto, you know, hollow core slabs on a project recently cut the embodied carbon of that project in half compared to everything else. And it's because it's, you don't have to imagine, it's not hard to imagine a hollow core slab. I don't know if it's like National Rigatoni Day or some form of extruded pasta, Lloyd, that you can do the hollow core day. But yeah, it's like there's big volumes of concrete taking out of a slab, and it doesn't necessarily increase the amount of reinforcement. I think that's a misnomer as well. And it's the setting of which it's set within, you know, and then it's put on a truck. But all that concrete's also coming to site on a truck, albeit one of a different truck bed dimension. But I think just to the technologies we have, like, there's reasons why we're so reliant on site poured concrete. And by the way, you know, Toronto's gifts to the world of construction are fly form concrete and window wall. We invented both of those things. How those have become so pervasive internationally, you know, in the last few decades, it's worth it. Somebody looking into that, like how fly form concrete, you know, led us away from systems that were reliant on far reduced volumes of overall of cement and concrete. Now the basement piece, and we're getting away from Paris a little bit here, but to bring it, I to come some back to maybe sufficiency, because I think that the basements are something I, you know, would love to go on about. But the other panel I was on was talking about urban planning, and in my 2 minutes, and it's all on YouTube if you want to watch all these panels now, was basically, why do we have basements, right? And there's basically, basements are the products of planning guidelines and bylaws. My argument was that we have basements in Canada because we've got planning loopholes. And I can, you know, I don't know if it's useful to bring it up, but basically we have planning language that creates a kind of massive loophole to create them. And then to make a basement, well, let's just think about what that is. You're digging a hole in the earth, you're taking that soil and you're driving it somewhere else and dumping it. And then depending on how deep your hole is, you're then shoring that hole, which is also very carbon intensive. You're shoring it with steel and shotcrete. You're shoring it so that you can then pour a foundation into it. And then you put a building on top of it. And what did you do that basement for? You did it to house cars, or you did it to house your laundry machine in a kind of single family house version. And that carbon intensity, that is all happening because we've created a massive loophole to allow it to happen. And, you know, the last time I think I was on talking about my first experience moving to Ireland, where I realized the whole world didn't have basements. Well, you know, right, much of the global south doesn't own a car and won't require it. And cities don't have parking minimums. And in fact, the first city that I saw that counted all floor area as floor area was Kigali, Rwanda. You know, it does not have this loophole. So I think even the bylaw that we think we're so advanced on, I mean, the bylaws we have encourage and engender a set of behaviors that are reasonings why we have such high embodied carbon per capita. And I'll finally say this last, is that, you know, right now the government of this country coming out, if you saw last week about the low traffic, the LTNs, what's that short for again?
Low traffic neighborhood.
Yeah, the new traffic neighborhoods, and the kind of, like, you know, the government kind of pushing the right of the driver, like against the findings of their own report. If you just think about, like we live in a kind of society that is making culture wars out of our right to drive everywhere we want as fast as we should. And it that permeates into our buildings quite literally, right? In the form of basement parking, in the form of garages, in the form of sprawl, like the planning relationship to this. That's why, back to kind of Will's, you know, talking about the global south, I've lived there and worked there. Our problems are much bigger to solve as a Canadian, as a North American, as a Brit.
Like, we need to look at ourselves first in the mirror and figure out how we're going to change what we are doing before we start talking about what their future is, because their future is inherently tied to ours. If we can't figure out how to live differently in Canada, then it doesn't matter what they're doing. It really doesn't matter, because our emissions dwarf theirs.
Is there not a question here? And this, how the hell do you do this without coming across as terribly paternalistic, of communicating our failures to those people and explaining, in other words, while people in the global south who have not created the conditions that have got us into the mess we're in now are starting to have fingers pointed at them, because they have a right to expect to be able to develop their countries, you know, and to have better longer lifespans, better quality of life, all that kind of stuff. What I'm getting at is, you want to create a situation where they recognize that there's a better way to do things, a way that will that will make them happier and healthier, a way to develop without replicating our mistakes.
Simple. We address our mistakes before we start talking to them about theirs.
I think it's really important to, so I always try and go back to donut economics when we talk about things like this, when we talk about the split between the so-called global north and south and how different things are, as if there are these two polar opposites and nobody lives in the sort of gray zone in between the two extremes for some reason. What does donut economics say? So it's about improving the life of all people within the capabilities of the planet, right there or thereabouts. It's about raising this sort of so-called social foundation without going beyond our planetary boundaries. And when we look at the global north, by and large, that yes, there are pockets where this is not true, but by and large, most people live relatively comfortable lives. They live above that social foundation. Levels of equity are fairly good and so on. But we have decimated planetary boundaries. And so when we talk about the built environment in the context of the global north, we need to be talking about, okay, well, how do you pull back within those planetary boundaries? When you look at the so-called global south, the donut completely flips. And University of Leeds have got a great website where they've studied every country in the world and plotted it against its own version of Kate Raworth's donut diagram. And if you look at almost any country in Africa, Southeast Asia, Central Latin America, it's the social foundation part of the donut that really needs work. And so for us to basically try and turn around the countries in the global south and say, hey, you need to tackle your emissions in the way we're tackling ours, is a bit misconstrued, because that's not what donut economics is advocating at all. It's advocating for you to understand what a place needs and then respond to that. So we need to slash emissions, but actually I think the planning piece is quite a good example of where you could imagine knowledge from the global north helping in the global south would be to sort of explain, yeah, how we've got things wrong in planning terms in a way that has led to us building in a high carbon way and advocating against that being replicated in places that, as Kelly put it, don't currently have cars. You know, there's the opportunity to leapfrog our mistakes. If you, most, I don't know if it's most people, there's a lot of iPhones in Africa, right? Like, a lot of people are connected to the internet and have a phone in their hand. They leapt straight past landlines and dial-up internet and all of that rubbish. And now you learn from Wikipedia. You have AI in your hand that helps you with your homework and tutoring and medical advice and things like that. And you can do exactly the same from a planning perspective, from a built environment perspective. The last thing I wanted to put into this, if I can, just to add it into the mix, because I do have to go at 11 o'clock sharp, I'm afraid. One of the things I slightly didn't like about the declaration that was signed was that it was written in this mindset that we've all been talking about in the last sort of hour, around this mindset of doing less harm, about reducing damage, right? So we talk about the need to create less waste, create less greenhouse gas emissions, create less pollution, have, you know, less child labor and bonded labor along our supply chains, you know, all these ridiculous things that less and less and less is good enough. The analogy I used to be able to try and explain how ridiculous this is if you imagine back to the days when you're, you know, maybe you lived with your parents or your carers and they went away for the weekend. What did you do? You threw a house party, you had all your friends around and they bought alcohol and pizza and so on. And when you wake up in the next morning, the house is a mess and you're panicking because your parents are coming home or your carers are coming home and you realize you need to tidy this place up. You don't continue to make mess, but make less of it than you were making the day before. You don't say, well, let's have a few more beers, but not as many as yesterday, and order a few more pizzas, but less pizzas than we ordered last night. You do the complete opposite and you clean up, right? And that's what needs to happen in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, waste, pollution, our approaches to equity, our approaches to labor. This mindset of less bad is never going to sort of solve things, because it's not going to draw down on greenhouse gas levels. We ultimately need to be putting this graph into reverse. And so you need to get into a mindset of doing more good. Wouldn't it have been amazing if the Declaration de Chaillot was written with that do more good mindset? Could you imagine how powerful it could have been if what was in there was basically saying the reason why we need to prioritize retrofits is because it draws down on waste materials. We need to be prioritizing the use of waste. We need to be prioritizing the use of materials that take pollution out of the atmosphere, that take greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. It sort of does it in places because it talks about the benefits of locking carbon up within buildings, sequestering carbon and so on, and that points to bio-based materials. But it doesn't make the explicit point that the power of it is in taking things out of the atmosphere. Wouldn't it have been great if there were clauses in there around working practices and supply chains that increased equity all along the supply chain, increased human health all along the supply chain, ended child labor, ended bonded labor, ended poverty, and so on? And I think that, I mean, my hope is that at some point in the not too distant future, there will be a revision to a text like this that takes that more positive look. Because if we are as impactful as we are 40% of global emissions, that also gives us the potential to become this massive force for good, right? If we had that different North Star, different end goal. So I wanted to drop that in the end. I don't know, Lloyd, if you've got reflections on that, because you've talked about this kind of thing in the past too.
I'm just going to say that your pizza and beer analogy is going to be as famous as your useless stuff phrase. It's a great demonstration of the issue.
For the analogy really to work, it probably needs to be that the parents have thrown a party and then woke up in the morning to realize that the children are going to come home and that the parents have decided that they're going to panic and do something about it, because that's maybe slightly more akin to the reality of the world. But it makes the same point either way.
Kelly, do you have any final comments?
Yeah, we've been, to extend Will's metaphor, we've been living the biggest party, you know, the globe has ever seen, certainly as long as I've been on Earth. And you know, maybe this declaration is the lights have come on and we realized, oh shit, we got to clean up. Party's over and we got to do something about it. And yeah, it is our parents. We are the parents. I mean, actually, I think like it's my parents and I've been at the party kind of engaging it for a little while. I came home and realized my parents had a raging party and then I got involved. And now I've got kids and I'm like, oh, wait a minute. We should probably stop this. Maybe this is the moment the lights come on for everybody. And just to wrap up on it, and it's like the mess is in our house, you know, to put a fine point on it. Like, we don't need to tell somebody else about don't throw a party like we've been throwing a party. Why don't we just fucking clean up what we've been doing and change our act, because you lead by your own actions. And I think that's how people will look and learn from and seek to replicate.
Excellent. Well, that's been really interesting. Thank you very much for all your time today, folks. Jeff, do you have anything you want to add? You've been very
no,
good.
No, I think that was great. I've got a barking dog here, so it's yeah, fantastic. Those two closing messages were phenomenal. It's kind of sick. It's sickening to agree so much.
I mean, the only closing point I want to offer is like, we don't really need to be telling the Global South anything.
Yeah,
like they know all of our flaws already. Like, that shit's the truth. We just need to be focused on ourselves. Man,
well, the big line in Canada, you know, about the right wing is, you know, Canada's only 2% of global emissions. Why should we be worried about the oil sands? It's China that's the problem. And we can't keep saying everybody else is the problem. What's the great line from Pogo? We have seen the enemy and he is us. So anyhow.
From Pogo? What's that? Is that the new Fortnite?
It's a comic strip from 50 years ago, The cartoonist did a thing for the first Earth Day, a poster, and was re-quoting an American general, we have seen the enemy, and he is us. What can I say? I'll send you the poster.
Dead on. Brilliant. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you for joining us. Thank you at home for listening. Join ACAN, join the AECB, join the IGBC. Check Kelly's half climate design. Will, where can people find you?
all over LinkedIn, or go to the iStructures website. If you search Institutional Structural Engineers, it'll come up. There's tons of free climate based resources on there.
Will, since joining iStructure, it's an incredible set of resources that have been coming out of the institution under with his assistant. So I would direct, structural engineers are not boring, and I think a lot of the most interesting conversations happening right now, I have to say, are among structural engineers in the UK.
For the record, I don't think structural engineering is boring. I think that this is just part of Dan's campaign to alienate all of our listeners. Yeah.
Well, you know, I have a natural inclination towards some manner of polemic. It's just more fun to talk like that. All right, check Lloyd's, Substack, Carbon Upfront. Everyone's on LinkedIn. There'll be plenty of stuff in the show notes. Oh, Passive House Plus, check it, subscribe, advertise if you can. That'll do for now, I think. Oh, yeah, subscribe, like, review, rate, and share with anyone you think might be interested. Any last plugs? No, we're all good. All right, well, cheers. Bye.